Good afternoon, everybody. Thanks for joining us. My name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'm excited to be moderating today's webinar on answering your dispute questions, which is being brought to you by MicroBuilt. Disputes are a very difficult area for companies in the credit and collection industry, from trying to figure out if something is a dispute to determining how deeply to investigate a dispute and respond to a consumer. Not everything is always black or white, when it comes to disputes. In this webinar, a panel of leading compliance experts from across the credit collection industry are with us today to spend an hour here answering your questions about disputes. This is a golden opportunity to get answers to the questions that are plaguing you in this area of your business. This webinar, as I mentioned, is being generously sponsored by MicroBuilt. You'll get the chance to hear more about them a little later in our program. I want to take a quick minute and say a few words about AccountsRecovery.net. AccountsRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the ARM industry. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use and is a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope you'll all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it has to offer. Now let me tell you a little bit about today's speakers. Dennis Barton is the owner of the Barton Law Group in St. Louis, which specializes in collection and defense services for members of the ARM industry. His firm represents collection agencies and creditors filing collection lawsuits in the states of Missouri and Illinois, and also provides letter review services, consulting on compliance best practices, and defense agencies against consumer lawsuits nationwide. He graduated from the Indiana University School of Business in 1996 and Washington University School of Law in 2003. He is a past president of the Missouri Collectors Association, as well as the ACA State Compliance Chair for the state of Missouri. He's a member of ACA's MAP Committee Education Council and holds a prestigious title of ACA Certified Instructor, enabling him to teach all core curriculum programs associated with industry designations. Michael Clutho is a shareholder with the Minneapolis law firm of Bassford Remily. A significant part of Michael's practice involves the defense of collection attorneys and collection agencies facing FDCPA, FCRA, and TCPA lawsuits. Michael has defended thousands of consumer lawsuits brought against collection professionals. His practice in this area also includes the defense of claims brought by government regulators, overseeing entities involved in the credit collection industry, and risk management, audits, and advice. Michael chairs the firm's Consumer Law Defense Practice Group. He frequently presents on FDCPA, FCRA, and TCPA and related issues, and is a certified instructor with ACA International. Alicia McKeegan is the Chief Compliance Officer at AFNI, Inc. She's been in the industry for 10 years and has experience building and enhancing AFNI's compliance management system. She also has experience with FDCPA, TCPA, and FCRA litigation and regulatory licensing. She is a member of the ACA International Federal Affairs Committee and holds a Credit and Collection Compliance Officer designation with ACA International. Chris Meyer serves as General Counsel and Chief Compliance Officer to the CMI Group and is responsible for managing all legal aspects of the company's operations, as well as ensuring compliance with all relevant laws and regulations. He joined the company in 2008 after working for an insurance defense firm in Dallas that specialized in defending collection agencies against FDCPA and FCRA lawsuits. Chris is an active member of ACA International and ACA Southwest and has served as guest presenter at several conferences covering topics such as legislative reform and in-house litigation strategies. The format for today's webinar is going to be a little bit different than most of my other webinars. We did a dispute webinar about a month ago and received more than 40 questions from the audience and really didn't get a chance to get to all of them. So I thought it would be a good opportunity to bring together some experts and spend time answering your questions about disputes. So this means we're definitely encouraging everybody to submit questions about disputes, and we will get to them as our discussion is ongoing today. To submit a question, please enter it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. This event is being recorded, and a recording will be made available hopefully by later today, but certainly by tomorrow on AccountsRecovery.net's webinar recordings page. Finally, I want to ask everybody to reserve a minute or so and fill out the survey that should pop up on your screen after the webinar is over. You'll also receive a link via email tomorrow to access the survey. Your participation, your feedback helps me develop content that's what you're looking for, such as the conversation we're going to be having today, and to bring the experts you want to hear from, which is definitely the case with the panel we have before us today. So with that, let's start answering questions. We had one that was already emailed in well in advance of today. So here it is. We sometimes receive disputes from debtors who have moved to a state we are not licensed to collect in. Should we respond to the dispute or just delete it from the credit and not reply? I hate to delete from credit since most of these disputes come from credit repair companies and not the debtors themselves, especially when we have documentation that validates the debt. Chris, since you're on my screen right now, we'll give you the honor of answering that one first.
Well, that's actually terrible because I'm probably not the best one to answer it since we carry licenses in every state that it's required. But I did give that one a little bit of thought, knowing that it was coming in advance. And to completely punt the ball right out of the gate, it's really going to be kind of a state-by-state inquiry, I think. And somebody else can correct me if they disagree. I know Michael Cluth and I did a presentation a while back on state collections issues. And really, the amount of activity or involvement you have in a state is what's going to give rise to the licensing requirements. So from my opinion anyway, if you're responding to a debt or responding to a dispute, you're essentially still trying to pursue the balance because you're telling them that, hey, this is owed. And so I think if you're still trying to pursue the balance, then you're going to have to consult with whether or not the licensing laws will allow you to act within that state. For us, if we get something from out of the country, then we just close it down. But we're kind of a lower balance, high volume shop, so that works for our model. I think if you're going after a higher balance and you've got the margins to do it, if you get a dispute that indicates the consumer has relocated, then you can put the time into figuring out whether or not you're going to run afoul of their licensing laws and figure out whether or not it's worth following up with them. I think a lot of times, though, it takes more than just a singular interaction with a consumer who's relocated to really give rise to any kind of liability for pursuing a debt without a license.
And Chris, okay, if I could just... Go ahead.
Sorry, Alicia, go ahead.
I was just going to add briefly to that. So in this question, the statement is made that it's a lot of these are from credit repair organizations. So, under the FCRA, you're not obligated to respond to a credit repair organization. But I do think it should be stated that if this was not from a CRO and it's an FCRA direct dispute, there is an obligation to respond to that. So if there are if this particular company or if your company is receiving a lot of disputes that are, FCRA direct disputes and you're not licensed in these different states, there needs to be some risk consideration made there because the FCRA obligates you to respond to these. So it would not be sufficient to just delete the account from the credit report.
Yeah, there is a lot built into this question, and it's a great question to start with. We're going to be, as we go through this hour, talk about some themes and give you some takeaways. And then we're going to dive down pretty deep into the weeds, which is a little bit of what this question is as well. And what Chris and Alicia both said makes sense. I look at it this way. There are enough cases out there now that say credit reporting is, in effect, debt collection. So if you come to learn that your credit reporting and you come to learn that a consumer is relocated to a state that you're not licensed in, and now that consumer is interacting with you, as Alicia just said, you're getting into a real sticky wicket there with respect to what do you do, because the way you can connect those dots is that you're collected in a state that's closed the border and you're not licensed. So that's the first thing to think about. I look at it from the standpoint of then diving deeper into the weeds. And I always, ask clients, is this worth it type of question on these, if it's a one-off sort of a situation, and Chris said, on a lower balance, it's pretty easy. If it's a bigger balance, I still think it's easy. I would just let it go. And from the standpoint of running the risk of getting caught, collecting a debt to a state you're not licensed isn't worth it. And there is this debate, and Alicia's correct. If you get a direct dispute, you're supposed to respond to the consumer under the FCRA rules. That's an interesting sort of a situation. If you're not licensed in that state, how do you do that? I think you pick your poison, and I would just delete it and not respond. And how I come down on it. I don't know. Dennis, what do you think?
I agree with you there. If we delete, I'm not going to respond. And I also agree that it's awfully dangerous from an exposure standpoint to credit report and to pursue a debt. And someone, you know, if someone lives in a state in which you're not licensed and it's a closed border state. But also kind of, as you touched upon, Michael, it's a business decision. I mean, lawyers, we just tell you what the law is. And as business owners, you make decisions based upon that. If it's a big balance and you want to roll the dice and take your chances, then go for it. But under this scenario, I would say from a legal exposure standpoint, you're going to run some pretty serious risks.
Okay, excellent. Our first question has come in from the audience, and hopefully we get a lot more here. So if you have a question, please ask it. We are having an internal debate regarding indirect disputes from CRAs. Is a breakdown of charges enough to validate an account when the dispute is not specific? Dennis, why don't you go first this time?
So you're asking there's a dispute and you're wanting to know how to best show that you've had a reinvestigation of it,
I think so. The ultimate question is a breakdown of charges enough to validate an account when the dispute is not specific?
All right. So therein lies what is the definition of a breakdown of the account? I'll take if you're talking about a ledger, or something that's showing the history of the payments and the charges and how interest was calculated, if there is interest and so forth, then that's part of it. If it's, let's say, a loan agreement, if this is, let's say, based on a loan agreement, you probably want to show both the loan agreement and the payment history, and I think you need both. Something you should be cautious of, though, and when I say depends on what you mean by the breakdown, is this if it's just in your system and it's a breakdown. I mean, unfortunately, I've had to defend cases where an agency will say as part of its reinvestigation and or even verification, separate from credit reporting, it just kind of spit out what it had in its system rather than relying upon documents from the creditor, which you can't do. I mean, the whole idea of reinvestigation or verification is to show that the debt is valid. And the only way you can do that is to show documentation from the creditor itself. So that's what I would say when it comes to responding to a dispute. You probably need to go a little bit more than just the payments in and out. Now, medical is a little different, right? Because if you just show the invoice, which is going to have a lot of that, then that probably is sufficient. You don't need to show medical records on top of that. But if it's going to be a debt that relates to a contract that gave rise to the debt in the first place, then you probably need both the contract and the payment history.
Hey, Mike, I've got I want to put a plug in for something that everybody, if you want a good takeaway from this session, go to the Federal Trade Commission's website, ftc.gov, and in the search box, search consumer reports, : what information furnishers need to know. What information furnishers need to know, consumer reports. And it has a really nice, you can print it right off a PDF that will basically serve as your policies and procedures and will answer 90% of your questions that we're going to go over today. I've got it in front of me, and it talks about, as this question says, an indirect dispute. That's one that comes in through the credit, the CRAs, and it talks about what you need to do. Investigate the dispute, review all relevant information provided by the CRA, and then report your findings to the CRA as to whether or not you need to correct anything. So that is not really going to ask you to do any breakdowns and this and anything. It's just they give you the information that they're shown as being reported. You need to investigate it and complete a reasonable investigation. What that is, it's kind of it when you see it. Verify what you need to verify, correct what you need to correct. If it's all wrong, delete it. But this particular kind of summary by the FTC outlines exactly what you need to do.
Hey, this is Dennis again, and I'm sorry, if the question was asking if you yourself have to create some document that shows a breakdown. No, you don't have to do that. The idea is to make sure that you have documentation from from the creditor. And oftentimes, I think anyway, you're going to need something that has a breakdown as part of the documentation.
And Mike, I see Scott asked, what is that search phrase again that you want to search for? It is consumer reports, colon, what information furnishers need to know. What information furnishers need to know. And it's a nice, like, 17-page summary of everything we're going to be talking about.
All right, excellent. And we got a question even I can answer. And that question is, will a recording of this presentation be available to participants afterwards? And the answer is yes. AccountsRecovery.net has a webinar recordings page where recordings of all of my webinars are posted, usually within 24 hours of the completion of an event. So you'll be able to go later today to download both an audio and video recording of today's webinar if you are so interested. At this point, I just want to pause the discussion for a minute and talk a little bit about the sponsor for today's webinar. That's Microbuilt. For more than 35 years, Microbuilt has been helping businesses assess and manage risk. They were a pioneer in the now exploding alternative credit data space, and as such, have refined their products and services to deliver true business value. Over the years, Microbuilt has invested heavily in acquiring best-in-class data. They've built sophisticated systems for keeping their data fresh and accurate, and powerful predictive models for making decisions around lending, leasing, collections, and risk management. With Microbuilt, you can customize the products you need and how much you want to spend, and all of their products are provided through a single, simple access portal. Whether you're working in originations or debt collection, screening a potential hire or tenant, planning for growth, or keeping up with regulatory requirements, Microbuilt can be your partner, providing the insight and information you need to protect your business, grow your bottom line, and keep your company running smoothly. For more information, please contact Microbuilt today at 800-884-4747 or visit www.microbuilt.com. And Microbuilt is spelled M-I-C-R-O-B-I-L-T, microbuilt.com. Thanks again to Microbuilt for sponsoring today's discussion. Now let's get back to some of the questions. Another question, what if the dispute is identity theft, but they don't specify account numbers and have included an incident report? Anyone want to tackle how that situation should be handled?
You know, I can speak to that. We've got, because this is always kind of a pain point for me with some of our clients. As to the first part of that question, if they don't identify account numbers, and I don't know if you're thinking that there might be multiple accounts in your system or you can't locate the account. In that situation, if they don't give you enough to work with, there's no harm or penalty for reaching back out to them. And just, we keep like a folder of things where if we receive a dispute or a fraud claim or whatever, if we can't pair it to an account, we have a folder of those that are logged by date. So we can always refer back to them to explain away, you know, for bona fide error defense or whatever, why we didn't act on the initial letter. But there's no harm in reaching back out to them and getting more information. As far as if they don't include an incident report, you know, we've got clients that are very particular in what they want to see for a fraud investigation. And it includes things like a copy of a driver's license, social security number, a copy of a police report, and a fraud affidavit from the FTC's website. And I think that's great. And I think if you're the one that's ultimately going to zero out the balance, that may be the threshold that you need to have met. But from our standpoint, I look at it as we're the ones who are pursuing the balance. We're the ones who are furnishing the information to the credit bureaus. And so we have to look at the information they provide to us. And if you can make a reasonable decision about whether or not they are the right person or whether or not they took out that balance, then you have to work off of it and not be so tied to what your client's expectations are. Just make sure you're communicating back to the client what you received, forward along the documentation that was given to you, and let them know what action you're taking so you can kind of tie up that loose end. But if I get a copy of like a driver's license and a fraud affidavit, I'm not going to hold out because I didn't go to the police department, because half the time I don't even know if a police department's going to be of much assistance. I mean, it's certainly not fair to put somebody through a bunch of different obstacle courses to clear up a debt that they never even incurred. But that really comes down to the specific dispute that you're dealing with and what information is included in that. If they give you proof of address, they're living somewhere else at the time services were provided for something like a cable account, that's pretty good proof that they didn't live there. So asking them to go to the police department too just kind of seems a little unnecessary, unwarranted. It's probably going to upset them a fair amount. So we try and keep a reasonable approach to it and then just keep our clients apprised of where we stand on things when we wrap something up with the consumer.
And Chris, if I could just add to that, I completely agree with everything that you're saying. You know, there's a lot of risk associated with continuing collections on an account that's claimed as identity theft, either through indirect disputes or, you know, through a letter that's being sent directly to you. And oftentimes, in the event that we would get a letter that we can't associate with an account, we have a similar process where we have a folder. But if there are multiple accounts that could potentially apply to, we would disposition that on all accounts and have a kind of internal system control that would, you know, remove anything related to credit reporting and close that account down as kind of like an internal close. So, you know, if the client's going to request more information, you know, perhaps we can reach back out and obtain that if that's a reasonable request. But, you know, the purpose being that we're not going to continue collections, we're not going to continue to make phone calls or send letters. Because there is a lot of risk associated with continuing collections on somebody who's claiming identity theft. And a lot of times it's not a very black and white kind of situation. You know, there are several different things that can come up when a consumer is claiming identity theft. So kind of just lasting thought would be just be very careful, step very carefully on accounts that have identity theft claims and really consider the risk associated with any kind of decisions that would continue collections in those scenarios.
You know, I always look at all questions that are presented to me as we're in this business to return money to our creditor clients for goods and services that they provided. If a person that we're trying to collect from says, I'm a victim of identity theft, my question back to an agency is go and search your accounts and find that subset of accounts where people have actually claimed identity theft, good, bad, and, you know, legitimate, illegitimate. But check and see how much money you've collected on those accounts. And I'll bet you dollars of donuts that you aren't collecting hardly any money on those accounts, but you're devoting a fair amount of, you know, full-time equivalent time to dealing with them. So that to me kind of drives the answer. And what Alicia just said is spot on. It's just not worth the risk. There will be a number of those people that will be telling you the truth, and they really are. So while the FTC in their guidance says if a consumer notifies you that he is a victim of identity theft and gives you an identity theft report, you may not furnish information to a CRA regarding the fraudulent account or debt. So technically it's just whatever debt they tell you. But as Alicia said, I just go across all the debts in that person's name and just flag them, take the credit reporting down, and move on to accounts where people aren't claiming identity theft.
The person who asked that question did provide some clarification. Not sure if this changes anybody's answer, but the additional information was, this is if a consumer provided a record ID in which we can locate, but there are several accounts under it. Does that change anybody's answer?
Doesn't change mine. I'd still just flag that consumer and all accounts attributable to that consumer and delete those.
Not a problem. Another question that's come in. Do you recommend a dedicated employee or group of employees for dispute investigation resolution as opposed to, say, a manager review?
I can speak for my company. We have a team of people. It's about 10 people, and they're working nothing but e-Oscar disputes and written correspondence disputes, and they report up into a manager who is under the compliance umbrella, and we do that for a reason. Kind of going back to what Michael said earlier about you're in the business of returning money to your clients, I think generally speaking, none of us are probably liquidating more than 10%, 15%, maybe 20 tops, depending on what portfolio or vertical you're working in. But that means 80% or more of the balances sent to you aren't going to get paid at all. Not surprisingly, the ones that are getting disputed, whether it's to the bureaus or a direct dispute to the agency, those are in that majority of accounts that are never going to get paid. So I look at them as a risk. And I want to make sure that whoever is the supervisor on those and is making decisions on the account is risk mitigation minded and not dollars collected minded. I mean, I think that's actually helped us quite a bit in terms of bringing down FCRA exposure, and then just bringing down general complaints and frustration and keeping things out of the agent's hands that are, you know, going to only deal with escalated matters because you didn't shut something down at the time you should have. But we have to have that many people. So it really depends on your agency. I think we get roughly, we get over 1,000 e-Oscars a day and over 100 letters a day. And that's Tuesday through Friday. Monday is much worse, obviously. And so there's no way for us to do it without having a team of people actively working on it at all times. But certainly breaking it out from operations has been beneficial to us, I think.
This is Dennis. One of my collection clients, which is a large client, operates in 38 states. It's a creditor client. It wanted to start credit reporting. And when it asked me for, you know, some of the number one considerations it should have in mind when developing its policies and procedures, I said, make sure you have enough people available to answer disputes. Because if you don't have a devoted team to just do that, too many things can be missed. And there's too many litigation attorneys that have their clients, or, you know, they on behalf of their clients dispute only for the purposes of setting you up for lawsuits. So making sure you have a devoted team of people that are able to respond to disputes and is really important.
And I think both of the points that have been made, if I could just add one additional element to it is, you know, from a regulator standpoint, if you're receiving disputes, especially on credit reporting, you know, indirect disputes, direct disputes, they're getting reports from the credit reporting agencies on furnishers and volumes and responsiveness specifically related to indirect disputes. So I think that, you know, you have to look at the volume of disputes that you're receiving and dedicate adequate resources to it. Now, if the question is, at what level do you have those managed? You know, your dispute team needs to be some of your best individuals that are very well trained, very well informed on your policies and procedures. As Chris said, it'd be an ideal situation that they're reporting up through a risk management group. But, you know, certainly if there are some things that need escalation, a manager oversight is helpful. So, you know, for example, in our FCRA dispute, if we receive something that we cannot find an account on, that would be escalated to a manager to then review to ensure that that account cannot be identified because there's some risk associated with not being able to find an account in a market disputed. So I think there are some scenarios that would require manager oversight, but at the end of the day, you really need to have a good support team that's proportionate with the volume of disputes that you're receiving and that is very well educated and well versed on your expectations and your policies and procedures.
Yeah, to highlight some of Alicia's points, there's an enforcement action pending right now, or I believe it's still pending, brought by the CFPB against FCO. I highly recommend reading it. The first time I read it, it kind of came across as penalizing efficiency. And the CFPB's issues had to do with the way the team that was processing disputes was getting training and oversight. And they felt like it was underwhelming. And part of how they arrived at that conclusion was looking at processing time. So it's interesting because you need to have enough people. You need to have a good enough crew to work through things so that there aren't, you know, 7, 10, 14 days out from receipt of the dispute, but it can't be so efficient that the regulator might look at it and say, well, you're not giving this the due attention. You need to have proper protocols for oversight to make sure that the disputes are being worked timely and effectively. And I think that's a really hard balance to maintain, you know, especially if you've got a budget like we all do that you have to contend with. So I would check out CFPB versus FCO if you haven't already read it. Just prepare to have your afternoon ruined.
Okay, another question that's come in. Is there a good way to deal with dispute letters sent from groups like Lexington Law? Do we have to respond to these disputes? Who wants to go first?
I'll take a first crack at that. And again, this is in that guide that the FTC puts out. And it's got a specific bullet point that says, you are not, and they bolded not, required to investigate a dispute when you believe that the dispute is submitted by, prepared on behalf of the consumer by, or submitted on a form supplied by, supplied to the consumer by a credit repair organization. So these Lexington laws and all those type outfits, it's not just if it comes directly from the credit repair organization, but if it looks like it was prepared on behalf of the consumer by, or submitted on a form that they had provided to the consumer. All those ways you can ignore them. But what I'm going to suggest is that we need to not play checkers, but play chess here and create nice databases within all of your agencies where you are maintaining, whether it's an electronic file, but I like to even see paper files if it's coming in by paper, where you can show that the same exact form came in on, 10 different accounts for 10 different people on the same day. All these people live in different states, yet they're all coming out with a pre-sort metered stamp type envelope. So you can just create the data. You get where I'm coming from, but create the database to show that these are, in fact, coming in from a credit repair organization. And then you just ignore them. But by playing chess, what I'm meaning is you can then think about going deeper and sending back to those consumers who really probably have no idea that even was sent on their behalf, a letter directly to the consumer to say, hey, we received this, and close a copy of it. Please explain to us what the nature is of your dispute, because they'll all be vague disputes. We're unable to do anything with this unless and until we get that information, and then see what feedback you get from the consumers. And you'll be surprised what you're going to get. You're going to get all kinds of, I have no idea what you're talking about. I didn't send that out. And that's incredible and valuable information that the industry could develop. And once it gets developed to a robust nature, then you have another Lexington Law type lawsuit like CBE Group did.
Okay.
I kind of want to add to that if we can, actually, Mike. Sure. Yeah, because that one's kind of a tricky one. I think, and I don't want to give them too much credit, but I do think Lexington Law or the other people who are doing what they're doing, I think they're getting a little more creative. And so they've taken that dispute notice that, as Michael pointed out, you don't have to respond to, and they've tried to throw some things in there that might actually require you to respond to in some fashion, or at least require the processing of it. I think the most recent version of the dispute letter we've been getting from Lexington Law, very last sentence is a request to cease correspondence. So what we would have done is just taken that giant stack of letters that all come in the same envelope with the same bulk postage and just thrown them in a bin in the side. Now we have to open them, locate the account, and make sure we put a cease correspondence on it so we're not still calling those consumers. And they're obviously doing that on purpose because they're just trying to be a thorn in your side to make you not want to pursue the balance because it's going to be in that majority that don't get collected. So make sure that if you develop a process for the form letter, periodically test to make sure that form letter hasn't changed in some significant way.
And Chris is spot on. You do need to read what they've sent in. I mean, the fact that you don't need to respond to it doesn't mean that it doesn't say that the consumer disputes it. That would mean you'd put a dispute flag up. That's a lot of what, the Stein Sox law firm is their model, the Collection Shield 360. So that's part of it. And what Chris said, they may be putting some ceases in there. I question whether or not a credit repair organization can legitimately do a cease and actually have an operative cease.
Agreed, yeah.
And that's a whole other question, but whether or not you want to be the poster child for that issue is a whole nother. You're certainly dealing with somebody who's somehow gotten linked up with an outfit that's going to muck up your system. And as Chris said, you're probably falling in an 80% category. You're never going to collect a nickel.
This discussion's also kind of touching upon the idea that it seems contradictory between they're sending you a dispute that may be seeking, an investigation and seeking documentation as well as cease and desist. And for anyone out there that gets a letter and wishes to respond but doesn't know if you can because of the cease and desist, the FTC does have an advisory opinion on that great website that Mr. Clutho referred to earlier. And that advisory opinion says that you may respond to the dispute, even though there is a a cease and desist provision.
And my comment is a little bit off topic, but just as long as we're talking about credit repair organizations, don't be that agency that says, you know what, no, we're going to be conservative, and you know, if we get a dispute, we're going to treat it. I think that you know, my response to many agencies when I've seen that is, you would be very surprised about the amount of time and resources that you are wasting on these particular letters. Once you're able to identify them, it's astonishing the volume that these particular individuals or outfits are sending to our agencies. So I know, again, not responding to that specific question, but as an agency, I definitely would encourage you to have a process that would identify these letters and kind of handle them accordingly.
Okay, moving on. A question specific to a new law in Washington State regards to the new validation requests we are getting that have no account numbers. The question is, how are other agencies handling those? Has anybody come across that and have any comments?
I think they just legalize marijuana out there. That could explain a lot of what's going on.
Okay.
I don't know the answer.
That's fine. Another question. Our company's fraud claim policy requires our subservicers to send a blank ID theft affidavit anytime a consumer claims fraud if the consumer did not supply a police report or ID theft affidavit. But we are having some pushback from a few servicers stating they view this as providing legal advice. Is this not a requirement of the FTC and others?
Yeah, I would have no problem with them supplying a copy of that form and asking them to fill that out. Somebody says I'm a victim of ID theft and sending them a form, I don't know how that would ever state a lawsuit, state a claim.
Okay. Another question, what about a written dispute within the 30-day validation period under 1692G that also comes with a cease communications request? Should we provide a verification?
Yes. And I think that's kind of what you were alluding to earlier, Dennis, about you've still got a window to respond to the request for verification, even if there's a cease request. A concurrent cease request made.
Correct. The FTC was more talking about the credit reporting, but I think the same thing would apply here.
And there's case law to support that too. Now, that doesn't mean that you ignore the cease request going forward. It's just for the one limited response to the request for verification or validation.
So just as a kind of a devil's advocate, the case law interpreting the FDCPA does say that unless you do need to cease in that scenario, and unless and until you provide verification, you can perform no further collection in the case of say. So if you don't ever provide the verification, you just shut the account down. That is legitimate and okay under the FDCPA. So I would ask the question again that I always ask is, do you make any money off of somebody who sends in a notice at the front end to cease and desist you? Does it make any money? I just don't know that those.
I agree 1,000%. We do have some clients that are pretty adamant though about reporting, for example, credit reporting. So we may cease down call and letter efforts, but credit reporting may still be on the table.
That one's going to be hard though, I think. Yeah, if you wanted to credit report that, Chris, I agree with you. You couldn't credit report it until you did verify it.
Right.
And flag it as disputed. I mean, you're going to be going in with a disputed credit report, which is, I don't know. I'd be curious as to whether or not you collect anything on those.
Well,
a lot of clients make
not.
You guys do things that get you into some risky situations. Your clients, you got to love them.
Mr. Clutha, you said you're playing devil's advocate. I'm going to play angel's advocate here. please keep in mind that just because someone has a cease and desist and your agency may not be able to move forward, you should you please consider your debt collection attorney and the wonderful avenue of recovery that can still be available. If I mean, there's lots of times where I have a client who can't collect anymore because of a cease and desist or dispute credit, you know, whatever the reason is that the client has come back and disputed and they just decide not to pursue it any further on their end, thinking that the legal process would be a better avenue for collection, and that it often is. So don't give up too quickly.
No, I agree wholeheartedly. That's your, you know, the hammer. Tell them, fine, here's your verification. And the statute also allows you to tell them that we're cease and desisting, and here's what we're going to do. You're getting sued. And then get it over to Dennis, and he'll hammer him.
Okay. The next question, are IZs and client system research or verification considered sufficient reasonable investigation to respond to an indirect dispute? Is one more preferable than the other?
I'm not sure I know what IZs are.
I didn't either, but I thought I'd ask on the off chance that someone was going to know.
Mike, I
everybody
think
else on this call is smarter than me.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. I was just going to say, I don't know what that means, but I think it goes kind of to the larger theme that we were all speaking about earlier in terms of reasonable investigation, and that the research or the investigation needs to be proportionate to the information provided. So, you know, if in the indirect dispute, it's disputing information that in order to refute, you would need to go into a client system and look at, that's what you need to do. If, you know, the IZ maybe is perhaps a simple ledger in your account system or your account notes, if it's just basic.
I think it's actually itemization now that I've gotten some clarification.
Okay, perfect. So, if there is something that is being disputed that would require for you to look at that itemization in order to, you know, verify the accuracy of the information furnished, then absolutely that needs to be looked at. If, you know, it's a simple dispute code that says not his, not hers, there's no FCRA relevant information, there's no images attached to that indirect dispute, then, you know, perhaps a simple system review, you know, your own system and perhaps some documentation you have would be adequate. So I think most of the circuits have agreed that, you know, as long as the investigation is proportionate with the information being provided by the consumer, by the credit reporting agency, it would be deemed reasonable. So that, I mean, there's not an easy answer to this other than just consider what's being provided and conduct your investigation based upon that.
Yeah, Alicia's spot on that. It's scalable depending on what the nature of the dispute was.
Yeah, it doesn't do you any good to look at like an itemization if the claim is identity theft. You know, more about the origination of the account, not the balance itself. So yeah, it always comes down to what's being said and what's being presented, if there's any substantiation, and then what information is available to you through your client system and what requires a step outside of that.
This is something we talked a little bit about last time, but didn't really get that deep into. What do you do when you get disputes on accounts that are either already have already been paid or are in the process? You know, someone's got a payment plan. How do you manage those?
Great question. Chris, Alicia, what do you guys do? You have a credit report.
Yeah, so, well, for all I can speak for us, if something's on a payment plan and we get a dispute, it kind of depends on if the dispute is a dispute of the full balance or if it's a partial dispute and the payment plan is for the full balance or just a portion of it. So if it's a $100 balance and they're set up a payment plan for $50 and they're sending us a dispute for the rest, then we would continue to take those payments and we'd work the dispute on the other part. But we often, it's typically not that way. We get a payment and then a few days later we get a dispute in the mail or from a credit bureau or whatever. And it's somebody who's just trying to get off their credit report because they're trying to get a mortgage or a note or whatever. So in those situations, we still conduct an investigation and we're either validating it that it is an accurate balance to the best of our knowledge, or it's not. And if it's not, we'd refund the money. because unfortunately there are some people that'll pay something just to get it off their credit report, and then they're going to deal with the mess on the back end. So we don't disregard it just because they made a payment to us. If we get a payment in the mail with like a written dispute with it, then we don't process the payment until we've resolved the dispute itself. More often than not, we say, or we'll send it back to the consumer and process the dispute separately, which may or may not be the best policy. And I can assure you, it doesn't make me very popular with the operations folks. But if you've got conflicting information about whether or not a debt is valid, to me, it's not worth the $150 payment we might get, because our commission on that is going to be a fraction of that. We're going to spend a lot of time cleaning things up.
I'm guessing that some people, I mean, believe it or not, some people do pay disputed accounts and truly legitimate disputes. It's a belt, like Mike or Chris said, they're trying to get a loan or what have you, and it's a belt and suspenders. They both dispute it, and they also pay it. And they're going to kind of deal with it on the back end, but, you know, they're not going to hold up their, you know, mortgage for $150 debt. They'll just take care of it and worry about it later. So, you know, you can take those in, but with respect to a dispute, whenever you get one and you sniff out that there is a dispute, you've credit reported, you have to put the dispute flag up and hope that, you know, what you're still reporting is good, accurate. You never, ever take that dispute flag down just because they're making payments or any other reason, unless that consumer tells you, please take the dispute flag down. It stays up for eternity. The second part of your question that you had in there, Mike, dealt with the accounts paid. And 6 months later, a year later, you're still putting a paid collection item trade line out there. My feeling is that that account is no longer in collections. It's closed. The money's been remitted. It's out of your inventory as a truly legitimate collection. Not legitimate, but active collection item. And I respectfully submit that at that point, you put in a deletion request because it's no longer in collections.
Another question, can you post a payment on a disputed account?
I say yes.
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 Easy. How would you handle disputes from consumers that claim another or more collection agencies called to collect on the same account when we are the account owner?
So I'll just I have some experience with that particular claim. I think that you need to do proper investigation. You know, some creditors refer from one agency to the next in a very tight window, and you know, credit reporting agencies aren't always the most responsive in terms of the deletion request. So there could be some overlap between when your trade line was, you know, still on the consumer's credit report and now this new agency that's now furnishing the information. There could be concerns or issues with the creditor system where, you know, they sent a recall to agency A and sent it to agency B, but agency A didn't receive that recall. So now both agencies are collecting on it. Or it could be, you know, an issue with the file transfer back from the agency to the creditor. So I think that when you're receiving those claims, although most of them probably aren't going to have any merit, you still need to really look at what could be the potential issues between, you know, the transfer of this account to multiple tiers because there is some overlap in furnishing if you're credit reporting, or because there are files going back and forth from the agency to the creditor, from the creditor to the agency. And whenever you have a little bit of complexity, there's always opportunity for error.
Sadly, I've been on the fuzzy end of this lollipop before, where we've had two collection agencies, you know, where the creditor did a double placement to two collection agencies, and then it was referred to me for legal, and we sued, and then a big LFT-CPA case was filed, and all this and that. But you know, and at that point, we just shut everything down. If absent the lawsuit, though, had we found out that there was a double placement, my advice to the client would have been to just stop collecting, shut it down until you regroup with the creditor to find out what agency they want this to be at, and communicate with the other agency to update the other agency too, because it may not know what's going on.
And don't assume it's an isolated incident either.
Correct. Yeah, that's a great point. That's a great point. If you have that from that one creditor, yeah, that's a great point. In fact, it probably isn't, right?
Right.
In my case, it wasn't.
I look at it, you know, one of the hardest things, Just real quick, one of the hardest things that you folks have to do in the industry is separating, as they say, the wheat from the chaff. You know, you only want to be collecting on the, if you will, low-hanging fruit, the easy accounts and all that thing. And some of these people are going to be telling you the truth when it comes to this type of situation, that, hey, it was, you know, there's two agencies coming after me or what have you. And all of us have seen that, that can be true. It's just figuring out when that is true. And so I will always come back to asking you the question. I hope that this is a very rare occurrence where you're getting this type of claim coming in. And if it is, that means there isn't a lot of money involved in it. So you really need to think long and hard about, is it even worth chancing that the consumer is, you know, telling you a lie, or just go ahead and accept it and close that account down, or at least do some digging, as Alicia and Chris just said. This may be kind of a canary in the coal mine, and you may find out that, lo and behold, you've got a creditor that's giving you some junk.
Okay, question. What should we do with the dispute flag XB after we have provided validation?
Keep it an XB, as far as I'm concerned.
Amen.
Yeah, I think, you know, AFNI in particular, and this is public. We are actually have furnished XH and have been involved in some litigation related to that. I think it's an individual choice. There's the risk from the litigation side in terms of, you know, if once you change it to an XH, if you validate it and you change it to an XH, is that accurate? But there's also kind of, you know, regulator expectation. So really, I think you need to weigh the risk of, are you going to get sued in litigation? Is a regulator going to, you know, be concerned about the accuracy of the credit reporting and the compliance condition code? Ultimately, I've seen a lot of agencies and surveyed a lot of my partners, and 95% of people are still just furnishing the XB. But we are litigating the matter right now, so stay tuned.
Good luck, Alicia.
Thank you.
Another question. There has been feedback that indirect disputes received from eOSCR generally consists of some limited disputes and not at the times the correct dispute code. And how do we validate that dispute? Sorry, how do we validate those disputes? You need me to repeat that? Maybe I bungled that up a little bit.
I'm sorry, if you don't mind.
That's fine. There has been feedback that indirect disputes received from eOSCR generally consists of some limited dispute codes and not the correct dispute code. How do we validate that dispute?
I look at it, that's going back to that's what Alicia was saying, isn't it? That, you know, you can only work with what they give you.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're giving you kind of some junk, you know, you do the best you can and just make a kind of a business decision that this looks kind of hanky and it's just not worth it, or we're going to muddle through it and hope for the best.
I will say some good advice I received from a very, very good attorney before Michael Clutho gave me this advice. He said tell your clients that just because they've received something that they don't like, if they're not going to close it out, you can't just ignore it. You do have to respond to it. So if it looks like, you know, you have some suspicions as to whether it's valid or not, if it's an indirect, especially if it's indirect through the credit reporting agency, and you can't, under the law, consider it irrelevant or frivolous, you still need to respond to it to some degree, even if it's to, you know, seek more information.
Okay. Do you handle suspected CRO-generated ID theft disputes with no supporting docs included by no response, or do you respond and request information from the consumer?
Interesting question.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I don't know. I mean, Alicia, and I don't do credit reporting. Alicia and Chris, do you folks actually, would you get an indirect from handle CRO generated. I see. That's one where I think you do play a little chess and go back to the consumer and say, hey, we got this. See, it's attached. Please send us a copy of your identity theft affidavit.
So I don't know how we would know it was CRO generated unless there was supporting documentation attached to the ACDV. And that's typically not the case, maybe less than 10% of the time. So we do, I mean, I would suspect the majority of disputes we get from the bureaus are generated by a CRO, because that's what the majority of our written disputes are, direct disputes are. We treat those the same because they're relatively high level. It's just, I dispute this. There's not anything to really investigate other than your client system. And we handle them that way, because it's, you can't ignore it with the bureau, because your response rate, again, as Alicia alluded to earlier, is monitored. So you have to respond. To request more information is probably not going to bear any more fruit anyway, and it's just an extra step. So we just treat them based on the information that's provided to us, as if it's from the consumer.
And if I'm
answering the question right.
And I would agree with you, Chris. And if it's a direct dispute, because I'm not sure if the intention of the question was indirect or direct, but if it's a direct dispute, in the way that we treat, just from a risk mitigation standpoint, ID theft's going to trump most things, just because it's not worth it. It's, you know, once they say ID theft, we kind of set that account aside and it goes on a different path. So if it's really a CRO generated letter that has those same kind of formats and stamps and all of that, that's going to get caught in the mail handling process, and then we'll, you know, kind of subsequently know ID theft, and so that's disposition. But if there's no supporting docs included, you know, you kind of got to make a decision. Do you want that to go down your, okay, this is CRO, and so we're going to ignore it, or it's ID theft, so we're really going to handle it with kid gloves? And in our situation, that's one of those where it's a CRO and assist, or it's a CRO and claims of identity theft, and they kind of take a little bit of a different path.
I'm not sure if this piece of information helps, but I think for clarification, it was the questioner said it was from the mail, not eOSCAR.
Yeah, so like I said, for us specifically, it's, we kind of subdivide once it's CRO and then determine, you know, if we want to continue to do anything based on, you know, the kind of the sub dispute within the CRO, or sub request. So CRO and cease, or, you know, CRO and attorney, or CRO and ID theft. Those all take a little bit different of a path.
It'd be the same for us too.
Okay. Well, we've reached the top of the hour, but before I let our esteemed panel go, wanted to get maybe some concluding remarks from everybody, or a summary, or some key takeaways, or parting words of wisdom, your best Christmas cake recipe, whatever you want to share at the end before we wrap up. Chris, would you mind going first?
Yeah, perfect, because then I can steal Michael's thought process he's been throwing out there. And that's just to be mindful about what accounts you're working. If you're in the dispute realm, if you're dealing with that population of accounts, they're probably not paying accounts. So just be smart about them. We do have some client requirements that we have to meet. But even with those, you know, you still go back to your client and say, we can't keep beating our head against this wall. You didn't retain us to get sued. You didn't retain us to deal with disputes. You retained us to collect the money that can be collected. And we're a business just like our clients are. And so working them in a way that's going to mitigate the risk for everybody involved is really the best approach at all times.
Okay. Makes sense. Thank you very much. Dennis?
Well, instead of summarizing, I did want to throw out one thing that I've heard of late a few times that I wanted to throw into the mix here. We often talk about what is a dispute, and a lot of people interpret it very broadly. And I just wanted to say that the one cautionary tale of, you just can't say anything is disputed and everything is disputed, because disputing a debt can have an economic impact on someone who's trying to buy a house or a car, and it shows up as disputed. I've had consumers contact me to say, this is showing up as disputed. I've never disputed it. You know, it's interfering with me getting a loan. What do I do now? How do I take care of this? And you know, that's just as not disputing something once it is legitimately disputed can be an FDCPA violation for not accurately reflecting the status of the debt. I think it's true the other way too. Saying something's disputed when someone has not really disputed it could also be an FDCPA violation. And actually that could have actual damages, which could create a pretty good lawsuit. So be careful being too overly broad in what you define as a dispute. That's it. Thank you. Well said.
Thank you. Alicia?
Unfortunately, I'm going to kind of just copy what Chris said. He took my kind of point. But really, it was just, you know, let's, as agencies, be informed on what you're doing. Do some analysis of the accounts that are being disputed, that you're receiving direct and indirect disputes on, the return that you're getting on, the investment that you're making on working those. And in that, pay attention to your regulatory obligations and, you know, your statutory obligations, and consider all of that, but be informed in the way that you're building your policies and procedures in order to put your position, your business in the best position, you know, both from a compliance standpoint and just a monetary resources standpoint.
Thank you. Michael.
Yeah. Hey, Mike, thanks. And I would commend folks to take a peek at the latest ACA Collector magazine on page 24 to see how important this topic is that Mike's put together for us. You will see a graph there, or a series of graphs, one on the FDCPA filings. You'll see those declining from a high of over 11,000 down to projected this year, 8,400. What you'll see in the next graph is the FCRA doubling over the last 5 years from 2,500 to 5,000 claims. So it's an upward line for FCRA claims and a downward line for FDCPA claims. So this is a really important issue, and as Dennis and others have mentioned, you can have actual damages when it comes to credit reporting trade lines. So do take it seriously. It is an area that has real risk. Dedicate qualified people, and please don't use a cookie cutter approach to looking at these. Make sure you get a good thinker in there when they're looking at evaluating and responding to disputes.
Awesome. Well, good thinkers definitely describes the panel we had today. Thank you very much, Alicia, Dennis, Chris, Michael, for your insights and your time. This webinar would clearly not have been possible without your participation. Also want to thank MicroBuilt one last time for sponsoring today's webinar. Please go to www.microbuilt.com to learn more about the company. Thanks to everybody who participated and asked questions. A final reminder to please share your feedback about today's webinar and share any ideas you have that you'd like to hear discussed on upcoming webinars. Really would appreciate that. I hope everyone stays tuned to accountsrecovery.net for news and more webinars in the very near future. Panel, amazing job today. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, everybody. Take care.